Okay, we begin Unit 2 now. I hope you love this unit just as much as you did Unit 1. We're going to start off with a survey of the four biological macromolecules, which you should know by the back of your hand at this point. What are they?
Proteins, lipids, nucleic acids, and polysaccharides.
Correct. And three of those qualify as polymers, right? Which one does not? Lipids are not polymers. They're big molecules, but they're built a little bit differently. Polymers are built by stringing together a bunch of monomers, right? And that's true for polysaccharides, for polynucleotides, otherwise called nucleic acids, and for proteins or polypeptides. Even though they are not polymers, what's happening in slide one still applies to them, still applies to building them or breaking them down. And so there are two different processes occurring here, two different chemical reactions that are really the reverses of each other. At the top, what we're doing is building a bigger molecule out of smaller pieces. And even though they're called polymer and monomer here, like I said, this still applies to lipids. The point is, you have smaller chunks and you're going to build a bigger chunk, all right? And notice that the smaller chunks, and this will be true for all four categories of molecules, the smaller chunks, somewhere on them, have an OH and an H hanging off. As you can see in the cartoon version, right? This has an OH and an H, this has an OH and an H. And putting those two parts together to make a bigger molecule involves an OH from one piece and an H from the other piece. And if you just imagine doing this with molecular models, ball and stick models, like you were using in the lab, you know, if you take something off of one molecule, then you're going to leave holes in it, right? Which means you're going to allow for the ability to make new bonds to replace the ones you're removing. So that's what's happening here. One of the small chunks loses an H. The other small chunk loses an OH. And that allows the two chunks to be covalently bonded together. But since one of them lost an H and one of them lost an OH, that means you have two H's and an O. And therefore, what is produced as a byproduct of this is water, H2O. All right? The water comes out, and the two pieces get sewn together. And that's why this kind of reaction that builds bigger things out of smaller is called a dehydration reaction, because you're removing water from the situation. All right? Dehydration. That, by the way, is what largely happens in one of the major subdivisions of metabolism. What is metabolism?
Well, the chemical reactions.
Right. Metabolism is the sum of all the chemical reactions occurring in an organism. So metabolism is life, because that's what life is, really, chemical reactions. Well, there are two subdivisions of metabolism, and those are called catabolism and anabolism. Anabolism is the part of metabolism in which you're building bigger things out of smaller. So that involves dehydration reactions, as I just defined them. Catabolism is the opposite. It's the part of metabolism in which you're breaking bigger things into smaller chunks. And that involves the opposite of dehydration, which is shown on the bottom of this first slide. It's exactly the reverse. Instead of water coming out of the situation, water is required as an input. And that water actually gets split into an OH and an H. An OH gets stuck onto one of the two chunks that results, and an H gets stuck onto the other. Just exactly the reverse of dehydration. But it's not called hydration, which would be the opposite linguistically of dehydration. It's called hydrolysis. Because lysis means splitting. So hydrolysis really refers to using water to split a molecule into two chunks. All right? And that is what largely happens in catabolism. Catabolic reactions split things apart. Okay, well, that's important for this chapter because these macromolecules don't start out as macromolecules. They need to be built out of smaller chunks. Yeah.
I look at catabolism when I think of the word catastrophe. Is that a way to kind of link the words together?
There's several words that have this an and cat in them.
Yeah.
Like anode and cathode, right, are opposites. And also, within biology, there are some species of fish that are called catadromous and others that are anadromous. It depends on whether you swim upstream to spawn or downstream to spawn as to which one you are. They're used in several words oppositely.
Okay.
They're antonyms of each other.
Okay.
Now, in slide 2, we're starting the part of the chapter devoted to polysaccharides, but what we're looking at here are not polysaccharides. So we started by looking at those two reactions, dehydration and hydrolysis, because as I said, you have to build big molecules out of smaller ones, and also these macromolecules don't necessarily stay as big molecules. They can be dismantled into smaller molecules again. So what we're looking at here in slide 2 are simple sugars. These are not macromolecules. They're all carbohydrates, though, right? Which is why I did not allow you to say that carbohydrates is one of the four macromolecule classes, like a lot of instructors would tell you that. Strictly speaking, that's not true, right? Carbohydrates is a very broad category of molecules, some of which are small, some of which are large. So the macromolecules that are carbohydrates are polysaccharides. They are polymers made by stringing together a bunch of simple sugars, which are small carbohydrates, called monosaccharides. Okay? And all of these are monosaccharides in this figure, but there are many, many more kinds of monosaccharides. Monosaccharides are simple sugars. Those are really interchangeable terms. They're the monomers of polysaccharides, as I've said, but what makes something a monosaccharide? Well, carbohydrates in general, which are based on monosaccharides, get their name. Why are they called this? What does that word look like? They get this name because the general formula for any given monosaccharide, of which there are many, many different examples, is CnH2nOn. In other words, n can be any integer, but in a monosaccharide, you have a certain number of carbons, you have that same number of oxygens, and you have twice that many hydrogens. So another simpler way of writing this is you would have CN, and then you would have N H2Os, right? You distribute this N, and it's the same thing. Well, this makes it look like any given monosaccharide, which are carbohydrates, are like carbon and water together because of that ratio. And that's why they're called carbohydrates, carbon and water. So any given carbohydrate will be made of carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen. And any given monosaccharide will have this ratio. That's true of all these, but it's also true of other monosaccharides. We learned in lab already that any given monosaccharide can exist in either linear form or ringed form. We're looking at the linear forms here, right? And what you see by the arrangement of this table is that there are two completely independent ways of classifying sugars, or simple sugars, monosaccharides. And they don't have anything to do with each other. That's what I mean by independent. First of all, just like other names of chemicals give you a clue as to what they are, like aldehydes end in AL, right? Like we've talked about in ketones end in O-N-E and so on. Well, sugars end in O-S-E. Monosaccharides and polysaccharides often have an O-S-E ending. They don't all, but when you see O-S-E as an ending, you're talking about some sort of carbohydrate, either big or small. And so think of that as sugar, because polysaccharides are still sugars, they're just complex sugars. Anyway, the columns show you one way of classifying a monosaccharide, and it's based only on the number of carbons that are in it. In other words, what the value of N is in this general formula. And so glyceraldehyde and dihydroxyacetone are both in the same column. Notice that if you count up their carbons, oxygens, and hydrogens, they have exactly the same chemical formula. But they're different substances, right? So they qualify as what with respect to each other? What do we call substances that have exactly the same chemical formula?
Isomers.
There's a lot of isomers in carbohydrates, in the group of carbohydrates. And that's true for glyceraldehyde and dihydroxyacetone. They both have C3H6O3 as their chemical formula, which is why that chemical formula is ambiguous, right? It doesn't tell you what you have. But anyway, they're classified based on their number of carbons, which is 3, as trioses. Triose is not a specific substance. It simply means a 3-carbon sugar. Triose. All right? And these are pentoses. Ribose and ribulose are both pentoses. They're not the only ones. Deoxyribose is also a pentose, for instance. 5-sugar is all it means. And hexoses are shown here. Glucose that you build is a hexose, but there's many others as well. So that's one way of classifying, simply on the basis of how many carbons are in the skeleton. The rows show you an entirely different way of classifying them. But first notice that any given monosaccharide, all of these plus others, in the linear form, as long as they're in the linear form, feature a carbonyl group, right? You made that carbonyl group in your glucose, but any monosaccharide you build would have it. Remember that the carbonyl is a carbon double bonded to an oxygen, right? So you see the carbonyl in orange on all of these. But remember back when we were talking about functional groups, which carbonyl is an example of, that in the case of carbonyl, there's two possibilities for the placement of that, right? Corresponding to two different carbonyl containing categories of compounds. What are those categories? Ketones and aldehydes. And how do you keep them? What trick did I tell you to use to keep track of which one's which?
The aldehydes have the HY, and then the ketones have the N, or the S, or N. Yeah.
That's linguistically true, but I'm talking about structurally, yeah.
Aldehyde A.
That's right. So aldehydes, which is at the tip of the alphabet, are substances with the carbonyl at a tip of the carbon skeleton somewhere. Just like in all of these. Right? It's at the tip. It can be any tip, and there can be many tips if it's branched. On the other hand, if it's somewhere other than a tip, like K is not at the tip of the alphabet, then it's a ketone instead. And so all monosaccharides are carbonyl-containing compounds, but some of them are ketones and some of them are aldehydes. And therefore, since they're also sugars, we call them either aldoses, if they're aldehyde sugars, or ketoses, if they're ketone sugars.
Yeah, and then I was going to say, so as you said with the tip, it also refers to the end of the carbon skeleton. So the beginning...
Any tip.
It can't be any of those.
Right. If there's a lot of branches, there can be many, many tips.
Right.
But as long as it's at one end somewhere,
yeah, okay.
Then it's an aldehyde.
And then if it's not, obviously.
Then all it has to be is one away from the tip, and that qualifies as it not being at the tip, and therefore it's a ketone.
Okay.
Let's go on to 3. Yeah, go ahead.
I had a question on the last slide.
Mm-hmm.
What is
the blue represents what's different about these two. These are isomers. These are all isomers, but glucose and galactose look very, very similar. The only thing that's different here is which side the hydroxyl is on. Because this carbon the one in the purple, mm-hmm. is a chiral carbon because it's connected to four different things. Remember we talked about left and right-handed versions? So there's a left-handed version and a right-handed version of this overall sugar, and they're different substances with different names. Now we can go to three and look at interconversion between linear and ring form. We've talked about this already several times, mostly in lab, right? You built the linear form. You couldn't just join it, right? You had to break some bonds in order to allow for the ring formation. And since you're completing that ring, it's going to have one fewer bond, right? That's why you had to break the double bond in order to make room for the completion of the ring. So this is important because any given isolated on its own monosaccharide can go back and forth between linear and ringed form many times a second. But only ringed versions of monosaccharides can be linked together to build bigger sugars. Okay? If they're in their linear form, then they're only monosaccharides. If they're in the ringed form, you can hook them together. But the ringed form, notice, even though it's the same stuff, glucose, for instance, it no longer is a carbonyl-containing compound when it's in that ringed form. So we still haven't gotten to polysaccharides because these are just the building blocks we've been talking about. Now in slide 4, we can see we're starting to build bigger ones. It's still not a polysaccharide, by the way. What's being built here in the top is a disaccharide, meaning two monosaccharides hooked together. And table sugar, which is on the bottom, is an example of that. Maltose is another disaccharide. There's all kinds of disaccharides because there's all kinds of monosaccharides you can use to build them. All right. What we call sugar, dietarily, is sucrose, but that's just one of many different disaccharides. Well, you can see, though, that building this, first of all, like I just said, requires the individual constituent monosaccharides from which you're building it to be in the ringed form, not the linear form. And also notice, like I was talking in slide 1, that building a bigger chunk out of smaller chunks requires one of those chunks to lose an OH and the other to lose an H, which become collectively water in the process of dehydration. So dehydration reactions build bigger and bigger carbohydrates. Now if you keep this process going, because there's nothing saying you can have to stop it too, then you eventually get enough monomers hooked together that it qualifies as a polymer, a polysaccharide rather than just a disaccharide or a trisaccharide. By the way, we don't usually use the word trisaccharide or tetrasaccharide, even though they make sense. If it's more than two, but it's not quite many yet, which poly means, we use the oligo prefix, which means several but not many. Like in an oligarchy. A monarchy is a nation ruled by one person. An oligarchy is ruled by several, but not many. Okay, so there are oligosaccharides as well. They all are built the same way, though, by dehydration reactions. And they have to be in the ringed form to do that. But one important thing about building a polysaccharide out of monosaccharides is that when you look at these ringed forms, notice there are multiple OHs and Hs on each one, which means there are multiple positions that you can connect another ringed sugar with. All right? And what that means is that if you're building a polysaccharide, it can branch. It doesn't just have to be a linear sequence, one after another. There are branch points because you could hook one on here, you could hook one on here, right? Two different sugars and it would be a branch point. So that's true for polysaccharides. They don't have to be, but they can be branched. On the other hand, polynucleotides, DNA and RNA, and polypeptides, proteins, cannot be branched because they don't have multiple places where you can hook them together. We'll look at those a little bit later. We can see some of that branching in slide 5. Right, here's a branch point. Here's several branch points. All right. But what we're looking at here in both of these cases, A and B, are examples of not only polysaccharides, because there's many monosaccharides hooked together, but functionally speaking, these are both qualified, or these both qualify as what are called storage polysaccharides. They're two functional classifications of polysaccharides: storage polysaccharides and structural polysaccharides. Structural polysaccharides, which these are not, are called that because they are large molecules built for the purpose of being a part of a structure. Okay, they're strong, they act like ropes, basically. Storage polysaccharides are not about being strong. They're just a more efficient way of storing the individual what used to be individual monosaccharides, which can be later used as fuel. Okay? So, if you take in a meal, once you actually digest it, which is still outside of your body, right? It's in your digestive tract, but that's outside of your body. Once you finally digest it into small enough chunks, and I'm talking about the sugars that are part of the carbohydrates that are part of the food, those get eventually digested into monosaccharides. Those are then finally small enough to be absorbed into the cells of your body through the lining of the gut, and they make their way into the bloodstream. So after a meal, your glucose level in the blood is going to go way up, above normal, right? That's an error signal if you think about it in terms of homeostasis, right? So that's something needs to be done about that. Negative feedback comes to the rescue, right? Something that'll bring it back down to normal. Well, this is one of the major jobs of your liver. It does a lot of things that keep you alive, but one of them is that when the blood glucose level goes up, the liver will take in a bunch of this glucose that you got from your last meal and hook them together to form a storage polysaccharide. It's a lot. If you take those waters out, it's a lot more compact form. But it's storing it for the purpose of using it as fuel later. You just don't need that fuel right now because you have enough in the blood to fuel your brain and the rest of your body. Your brain uses almost nothing but glucose as fuel. So you have to have a steady... This is why it's really dangerous if your blood glucose level drops. But it's also bad if it goes too high. All right? So that's when you're taking in more than you need. Then hours later, it's been hours since you've eaten, well, your brain's been using the glucose all along, so eventually your blood glucose is going to go below normal, right? And the liver will respond by reversing the process it did earlier, which was to build a storage polysaccharide. It will now dismantle that storage polysaccharide that it previously built, breaking it back down into the individual glucoses that it was made out of, and spilling those glucoses out into the blood so the brain can stay alive. All right, so it's building by dehydration, and then it's breaking it down by hydrolysis later. But anyway, that's why we qualify these things as storage polysaccharides, because they're not about building stuff structurally. They're about simply storing fuel for later. And we animals do this, but plants do it as well. We do it a little bit differently, though. Starch is shown in the left. That's a plant storage polysaccharide. That's what they make primarily to store their extra glucose. We store ours a little bit differently by making glycogen. But in both cases, not only are they storage polysaccharides, they're both made out of nothing but glucose. Glucose is not the only monosaccharide, as I've said, but it's the only one that's used to make glycogen and starch. Glucose, by the way, is important for being the master fuel in all cells. So it's the most common biological monosaccharide because all cells use it. All right. So what is different about this is that animals have a more branched version of their storage polysaccharide, which makes it even more efficient to store, and it also makes it faster to dismantle, which is important in an animal because we move around. We have to have a higher metabolism than a plant does. But anyway, that's the purpose of a storage polysaccharide. On the other hand, in 6, we can see on the right an example of a structural polysaccharide. Now, starch is shown on the left. We just looked at that. That's the same exact stuff. That's a storage polysaccharide. Nothing but glucose hooked together. Well, cellulose, which is a major plant structural polysaccharide, is made for an entirely different reason. It's made as little fibers that can be for structural reasons. But it is also nothing but glucose. So one thing about this is that, first of all, there's not only are there multiple different hexoses, all with the same chemical formula as glucose, because it's a hexose, right? They're all C6H12O6, all hexoses. But there are even multiple different versions of glucose, alpha and beta, as you see here. And the only difference between them is whether or not this OH is above the level of that ring or below it. Okay? Otherwise, it's the same thing, but they're both glucose, but different versions. And if you use the alpha glucose versions to link them together, you make a storage polysaccharide, if you're a plant, called starch. If you use the beta glucose monomers, then it ends up being staggered, as you see here, and that's not for the purpose of storing it as fuel, that's for the purpose of building little ropes, which cellulose is, more or less, functionally speaking. Oh, I forgot to mention in this whole thing that, let me just go back to show you the term glycosidic linkage. Should have been here somewhere. Oh, maybe it's not.
It's right above.
Oh, yeah, it is. When we're talking about forming these bonds to build bigger pieces out of smaller chunks, depending on which category of macromolecules we're in, these bonds have different specific names. So in the case of carbohydrates, building polysaccharides out of monosaccharides, the name for the covalent bond formed between two adjacent monosaccharides is glycosidic linkage. All right? And what I was saying earlier is that since there are multiple OHs on the ringed form of a monosaccharide, there are multiple different places where you can make a glycosidic linkage with another monosaccharide. That's why they can be branched. So that will apply only to sugars. We'll have different names for the bonds in other categories of macromolecules. Now back to 7. Well, this just shows you a major use of cellulose fibers. This is a structural polysaccharide, and each one is tremendously long. It's a lot of different glucoses bonded together. But then you can take multiple individual cellulose polymers and put them in parallel like strands of a rope. And, you know, actually strands of a rope are cellulose because you get those from plants.
Those, like, top two, like, zoomed-in images?
Yeah.
Are we actually able to, like, zoom in that close, or is that just what people assume is, like...
No, that's real. These, in fact, this is a real photomicrograph. So is this. These are actual pictures. This is a single cell, though. And one thing, cellulose is used different ways, but cellulose is really important in plants because it's a major component of the cell wall. So all the cell wall is exterior to the plasma membrane. So it has a plasma membrane made out of phospholipid bilayer, just like we've talked about all cells have. And then exterior to that is a cell wall, much thicker and much stronger, made mostly out of cellulose, in the case of plants. For archaeans, by the way, which also have cell walls, they don't use cellulose, they use something different, which is why one of the main reasons why they're in their own domain. Okay, 8. Picture of a cow, in case you haven't figured that out. This is just one of many examples of mammals that are able to eat things with cellulose in them and get nutrition from them. We can't, as humans, we're fellow mammals, but we are mammals who cannot get any nutrition from cellulose. Even though, as I just told you, cellulose is nothing but glucose, right? So it's chock full of energy, But when you use sugar for energy, which is the primary fuel, you don't burn polysaccharides. You burn or use for energy monosaccharides. So glucose is fuel, but if you don't have a way to break the polysaccharide down into the individual glucoses, then it's not going to give you any nutritive value. We call this roughage, right? Cellulose is indigestible. And that's simply because in order to use it as fuel, you'd have to break those glycosidic linkages holding all the glucoses together to make it into individual glucoses, right? Well, in starch, since it's built differently compared to in cellulose, which is built differently from starch, it requires a different kind of enzyme to act as the catalyst to break those bonds. And we, as humans, do not make that enzyme. If we had a gene that coded for the protein that would act as the enzyme to break the glycosidic linkages in cellulose, then we could eat paper or any other cellulose and we would get energy out of it. We can't, though. Actually, neither can the cow or any other animal, though. They can't do it just as we can't. So how do they actually get nutritive value out of cellulose? By housing in their stomachs, symbiotically, microorganisms. Bacteria that are able to produce that enzyme that can break down cellulose, and therefore, well, of course, the bacteria are doing that for themselves. This is an example of endosymbiosis. Bi, as in biology, means life. Osis means condition. Sim means together, and endo means in. So endosymbiosis is the condition of something living inside something else. And not only is it endosymbiotic, but it is mutualistic, which is just a word that means both of the two species involved benefit from the arrangement. So as I was saying earlier, the bacteria are breaking down this cellulose for their own energy, right? That gets them glucose. But by doing that, they also free up glucose for the cow to use for its own energy. And as long as the cow eats, the bacteria get a nice, safe, moist, warm place to live with free food, and the cows benefit by getting the nutrition from it. Slide 9 shows you that it's not just plants that make structural polysaccharides. Cellulose is a plant structural polysaccharide, but some animals make a structural polysaccharide called chitin, spelled thus, which is the tough stuff out of which insect exoskeletons are made. Right? We have an endoskeleton, bony. They are soft inside and really are just wearing plate armor, more or less, made out of strong chitin, which is an animal version of storage polysaccharide that we take advantage of its strength, by the way, by making surgical thread out of it.
Humans
have been around for a while and we've been trying different things for a long time. That is a brief overview of carbohydrates, but both big and small and big. Now let's go on to lipids, slide 10. And there are different major subcategories of lipids. All lipids, though, are, first of all, they're not officially polymers, even though they're they're macromolecules, but they're not as large as the true polymers. They're just large compared to run-of-the-mill molecules like water and oxygen molecules and things like that. But there are major categories within lipids, one of which we're looking at here on the bottom. This is a fat, and I told you in an earlier lecture that fat can go by any of three names. Fat is one. But you can also call them triglycerides, which is spelled this way. And that's what most biologists would call them. Or they can be called triacylglycerols, which is what most biochemists would call them. Triacylglycerol is kind of the best name for them in terms of telling you what the actual molecule is built like. Because what you have in any given fat or triacylglycerol is a glycerol, which is this part in gray. Now, if that were by itself, you can see it at the top as well. You ignore this thing that's hooked to it, and it's just by itself with that blue hydrogen still on there, then that is by itself a molecule, a complete molecule called glycerol. What is that? What kind of molecule is that? The name should tell you. It's an alcohol. That's why it ends in OL, glycerol. All right? Not only is it an alcohol, it's a triple alcohol, right? Because it has three different hydroxyl groups. Hydroxyl group is what makes something an alcohol, remember. So it's triply an alcohol. But because of what I told you about small chunks having either an H or an OH hanging off of them, that means there's three different places on a glycerol where you can make a connection with a different thing. And in the case of fats, all three of those connection points are used to hook on the same kind of thing. And that thing that's hooked onto the glycerol is a fatty acid, which is just the orange part at the top, as it's labeled. All right. Now, a fatty acid, at one end, has this functional group. What is that? It's a carboxyl at the end. So fatty acids are carboxylic acids. That's why they're called fatty acids, by the way. Remember that if you have a carboxyl, you're a carboxylic acid. So that's what makes it a carboxylic acid, that carboxyl at the end. But if you didn't have that carboxyl, if you look at the rest of it, the vast majority of the molecule, just the fatty acid, how would you categorize that if you didn't have the hydroxyl? Just all the rest of it, you would describe as what? What's it made out of? Okay, so what is it? A hydrocarbon, or it would be if that's all it had. If you didn't have this carboxyl, it would be a hydrocarbon. And hydrocarbons are excellent sources of energy, which is why gasoline is a mixture of different hydrocarbons, right? There's a lot of energy in that if you dismantle those carbon-hydrogen bonds. And this is why fats or triacylglycerols or triglycerides are excellent ways to store energy very efficiently because of all the carbon-hydrogen bonds in the fatty acid tails of the fat. All right? They have a much higher energy density than proteins do or than carbohydrates do, as the three big nutrient classes, carbohydrates, proteins, and fats. Fats have more than twice the energy density of proteins or carbohydrates, which means for a gram of fat, there's more than twice as much energy stored in that gram as there is in a gram of protein or a gram of carbohydrate. And this is exactly why no matter what we take the food in or the calories in as food, it can be pure carbohydrate, for instance. You know, candy manufacturers love to put on their labels no fat, which is true. It doesn't contain any fat. It's pure sugar. But when you take in more than you need at the moment, we've evolved to save that extra because food over evolutionary time has been scarce. So we transform it from whatever we take it into fat, because that stores it a lot more efficiently. If we stored it as protein or as carbohydrate, we would have to weigh a lot more to contain that same amount of energy in our storage, and we would be therefore have to waste energy to move around a heavier body. Yeah.
You know how like Americans typically eat like more food than the rest of the world?
Yes.
Do you think that like our bodies will ever evolve to like not store it as much because we're eating so often?
Well, I don't think that's going to happen because I'm pretty sure humans are going to go extinct pretty soon.
That's nice and hopeful.
Well, I'm serious about this. Global warming is probably not going to allow us to live much longer as a species. But natural selection could work that way if, but only if, it affected reproductive success. For instance, people would have to say, I am not going to mate with a person who stores a bunch of fat on his or her body. Because that's the only way to allow those alleles to be taken out of the population. Well, it would take a long time, too. I mean, unimaginably long time for that to probably happen. There's nothing prohibiting it. I mean, natural selection can work if you have alleles pop up for the new trait. Okay, now this is how you build a fat molecule. You hook together three fatty acids onto a glycerol at three different individual places, though. Okay? The reason it's three is because the glycerol has three hooking places. Now, in the case of sugars, when we linked them together, we called those glycosidic linkages, right? Here you're using the same process, namely dehydration reaction, to link a fatty acid to a glycerol to build a fat, but we don't call those glycosidic linkages. We call these ester linkages. And so there's three ester linkages in a fat, one for each of the fatty acids connected to the glycerol. Okay? Now, there are different kinds of fat for two major reasons. One is that there are different kinds of fatty acids. Actually, that's the reason. That's the one reason why there are different kinds of fats. But there are two reasons why there are different kinds of fatty acids. These happen to be all exactly the same fatty acid. And that's allowable. This fat has three of the same. But a different fat could have two of the same and one another, or all three different. And they can all be different ones compared to this. Okay, so there's multiple different kinds of fatty acids. All glycerol is the same, but it's the fatty acids that make different fats different. Why is it that you can have different kinds of fatty acids? Well, tell me. There's two different ways, as I said. But what do you notice is the same on all three of these that makes them the same? These three fatty acids are identical because of what reason? Well, even before you link them together, if they're fatty acids by themselves, what is the same about all of them? And don't overthink it.
The end.
What?
The end.
Well, you mean this end?
Yeah.
It is, but what do you mean by that? That's true. What else, though? Actually, no, that's wrong. But I'm glad you brought it up because it actually answers the question I'm trying to get you to answer. Yes, this does end in a hydrogen, but who says it has to be a hydrogen? You could put another carbon here and three more hydrogens, right? In other words, you could make this as short or as long as you want. There's nothing saying you have to have this many carbons. Right? You can keep going. You can have a carbon here and then three hydrogens or two carbons and you just fill it up with hydrogens, right? So that's one way in which fatty acids differ from each other in their chain length, how many carbons are in them. Okay? Yeah, but organisms use a pretty narrow range, so they don't get tremendously long, they don't get real short. They do vary in size, but not much within organisms. But chemically speaking, there's no reason you can make them any length you want if you're designing them in a laboratory. Okay, so that's one way in which fatty acids differ. Slide 11 shows you a different way. We have, for any given fatty acid, we have two, or I mean for the group called fatty acids, we have two subcategories. Those are called saturated fatty acids and unsaturated fatty acids. Okay? Now go ahead with your question.
For the last slide, and you said that there's a certain amount, what certain amount of range is it? What's the minimum, what's the maximum for the fat, or for the
a little bit below 10 probably to high teens is most of them, the vast majority. Yeah.
Wait, sorry for the last slide. You said two ways to fatty acids decrease in the length of the chain. What was the second one?
The second, well, I haven't actually completed the explanation of it, but I'm telling you that there's two different categories, saturated and unsaturated. So that's the other way that they can differ on their degree of saturation, whether they are saturated or not. But I still haven't explained what that means. So when you just think of the word saturated in everyday language, what does that mean?
Something's full of something.
Full, exactly. Saturated things are full of whatever. They can't hold anymore, right? Like a saturated sponge cannot hold any more water. Well, what's saturated in a saturated fatty acid, the reason that we call it that, is hydrogen. It is saturated with hydrogens. It's holding as many hydrogens as possible. So for a given length of carbon skeleton, right, that's not changing. If you're going to hold as many as possible hydrogens with that many carbons, then you're going to have nothing but single bonds between the carbons, right? Because that will free up as many holes as possible to be occupied by hydrogens. In other words, it's saturated with hydrogens. Does that make sense? So a saturated fatty acid has nothing but single bonds in the hydrocarbon part of it. The only thing that's a double bond is the part that's the carboxyl at the end. Okay? And all of these are saturated. You can see they're all single bonds, single lines mean single bonds. And if it's a saturated fatty acid, however short or long it is, it's straight. On the other hand, if you have to make a double bond, and it can be one double bond or more than one double bond anywhere in the chain, but if you have just one, then it's no longer a saturated fatty acid, because if you have to make a double bond, which imagine making the springs, right, in the ball, you're going to have to get rid of a hydrogen from each of the two carbons in order to make that double bond. So it's no longer saturated with hydrogens. Not only does that qualify it as being unsaturated, the fatty acid, but that double bond is going to form a little bend, so it's not straight like a saturated fatty acid. Now, if you imagine just working with wires, stiff wire that represents fatty acids, you could have them long or short, right? Doesn't matter. That represents the length of the carbon skeleton. But if they're all straight, none of them is bent, then they're going to pack together well if you throw them into a box, right? They're going to be right next to each other. On the other hand, if you have a bunch of bent ones, especially if they're bent at different places, and you throw them into a box, there's going to be a lot of space between them. They're not going to be as solid, right? Because solids are things with the particles very close together. And that's important in fats. Just as fatty acids can be classified as saturated or unsaturated, fats can be as well. A saturated fat is any fat that it consists of only saturated fatty acids. All three of them are saturated. If only one of the three fatty acids is unsaturated, then the whole fat is considered to be unsaturated. But this is where you come into words, and you see this in dietary, on commercials for instance, words like monounsaturated and polyunsaturated. Monounsaturated means there's only one double bond in that fat. Polyunsaturated means there's many double bonds. Well, those bends make that fat less solid because of that extra space. And animals tend to make, when they make their fats, they tend to make, because we're animals, we tend to make mostly saturated fats with those bends. And without those bends, sorry. Saturated fats don't have the bends. And therefore, our fats, animal fats, tend to be at room temperature more solid, which is why when you make things like butter, it's like a solid at room temperature. On the other hand, plants make mostly unsaturated fats for their fat, and those tend to be liquid at room temperature, oils instead of things like lard or butter. Okay. That's one category of lipids. In slide 12, we're looking at a different category. This thing is in the middle, a cartoon version of a phospholipid, which the name, of course, indicates it's a type of lipid. This is a monumentally important molecule in biology. It is literally impossible to overstate the importance of phospholipids, because there would be no life without them. There would be no cell, because every cell has to have a plasma membrane, right, to define the cell. And in all three different domains of life, all cells that have ever existed, in other words, the plasma membrane is mostly made out of phospholipid bilayer, two layers of phospholipids. Right, we've talked about this before already. What is the special characteristic of phospholipids that makes them self-assemble into a bilayer in the presence of water? What's the word? I think I gave you this word. They are amphipathic. Did I mention this? Okay, I'm thinking of a different class. Amphipathic. Pathos means feeling, like in sympathetic or empathetic. What does amphi mean? Amphibian is a good example. And just like the bi of endosymbiosis, same as in biology, means life, amphibian means having a dual lifestyle. Amphi means dual or both. An amphibian is a dual lifestyle because they live part of their lifetime in water and part of their lifetime on land. And similarly, an amphitheater. An amphitheater is partly outside and partly inside. So it's dual. So amphipathic means having dual feelings or dual preference. We use this word, obviously the chemicals don't have any feelings, but we use this word to describe chemicals like phospholipids that are polar on one part of the molecule and nonpolar on another part of the molecule. All right, now water is polar. We've already talked about why it's polar. It's not amphipathic, it's just polar. A phospholipid is amphipathic, partly polar and partly nonpolar. And that is the whole reason we exist, because many phospholipids, each of which can be cartoonized as a circle with two tails, when a bunch of those are together in the presence of water, they will automatically assemble into a bilayer in which the tails in one layer are facing the tails of the other layer. And that's only because, it has nothing to do with life, these are just non-living molecules will self-assemble this way simply because of polar molecules not liking to be around nonpolar molecules and vice versa. All right? So, in a phospholipid, notice that it is built very similarly to a fat that we just looked at. Meaning that there is, just like in a fat, a glycerol with its three connection points, right? But in a fat, all three of those connection points are used to hook on a fatty acid. And the overall fat that results is nonpolar. By the way, I should have mentioned that when we were talking about fats. The fatty acids, which are hydrocarbons in general, are nonpolar. Because you tell me why. What makes anything nonpolar if it's a covalent compound? That's exactly right. The electronegativities of the atoms involved in the bonds is exactly or close to being the same. And that's true for carbon and hydrogen. They have almost exactly the same electronegativities, so they almost exactly equally share the electrons in the bonds. Therefore, a hydrocarbon is nonpolar, which is why gasoline does not mix with water. Water's polar, hydrocarbons aren't. Okay, so back to this building. It has the same glycerol with three connection points, But in a phospholipid, unlike a fat, only two of those positions is used to hook on a fatty acid. The third place, instead of hooking on a fatty acid, is used to hook on a phosphate group, which is why these things are called phospholipids. Remember that a phosphate has a charge to it, right? So it's actually beyond polar. Polar is partially charged, right? A phosphate is fully charged, so that's even more than polar. And there are different kinds of phospholipids because there are different kinds of fatty acids, but there are also different things that are hooked to this phosphate. In any given phospholipid, though, we have a so-called polar head, which is the circle in the cartoon, connected to two non-polar tails, because they are largely hydrocarbons, right? Fatty acids. Now, two related words are shown on the right of this screen, hydrophilic and hydrophobic. Polar things are classified as hydrophilic, which literally means water-loving, right? Well, water is polar. Polar things like to be around other polar things, so that's why we call polar things hydrophilic. Hydrophobic literally means water-fearing. Of course, these are really, there's no real emotions in these. But hydrophobic is another name for a non-polar thing, because they do not want to be around the polar water. Well, that's what's happening here in this self-assembly process. The hydrophobic tails are trying to avoid water. They can do that by hooking onto themselves, well, not really hooking, but getting near each other and staying away from the water that's on the inside of the cell or the outside of the cell. On the other hand, the polar heads have no problem being right against that water inside or outside the cell. So this happens automatically, and that's how the first cells came into existence. Because once you had these phospholipids in the environment, which are building up over time, then they will self-assemble into these vesicles, which are like cells, only not quite cells yet. Okay, so truly important molecules in biology, but they're a class of lipids unto themselves. By the way, just like fats can be qualified as saturated or unsaturated, phospholipids can as well. And this is one way that the cell can adjust how loose its plasma membrane is, by either making the plasma membrane out of saturated phospholipids or unsaturated ones. I'll talk more about that in a different chapter. 13 just shows you the phospholipid bilayer. Now, this is not a cell. This is just something that would automatically form if you had a bunch of phospholipids in water. But this is how cells came into existence originally. So a full plasma membrane needs to be more than just a phospholipid bilayer, because certain things can get through it and certain things can't. Well, there are things that a cell has to get through the membrane in order to live. And if they can't get right through this phospholipid bilayer, then you need something else making up the membrane as well, which is other things, mostly proteins, that can get things through it. Okay, 14. We're still in lipids, but this is yet another category. Anyone know what this is? We've talked about it before. When you see these four rings in this arrangement, it is cholesterol. Which is what kind of thing? It's an alcohol, right? It ends in OL, just like ethanol does and glycerol. So there should be a hydroxyl somewhere. Well, it's right here. This is what makes it an alcohol. Cholesterol, by the way, is made by animals, not plants. Plants make a similar thing called phytosterols. They're both sterols, which means solid alcohol, three-dimensional alcohol, because of these ring structures. Phyto means plant, by the way, so that makes sense. Coal means bile. So cholesterol literally means bile, solid alcohol, produced by the liver, which produces bile. Cholesterol is a major component of bile. So cholesterol does various things. It's also a major component of animal plasma membranes, along with those phospholipids. You can adjust the permeability of the membrane to ions by adding or subtracting cholesterol. So it's important for that reason. Also, in animals, all of the steroid hormones start out as cholesterol, right? Testosterone, estrogen, progesterone, and also the sugar-adjusting ones like cortisol. Those all start out as cholesterol, and they're not really much different from cholesterol. They look just like this, same ring structure. It's just one or two of the functional groups that are sticking off of that ring. Those rings will be different in the other ones. And that's enough to make you have such a drastic difference in function as you see, for example, between testosterone and estrogen. Now we're into the next major category of macromolecules, which is proteins. And proteins really do just about everything in biology. Every biological process, or a major process, either is performed directly by proteins or it involves the help of proteins in order to get it done. And remember, I've said several times already that proteins are what give an organism its traits, right? Not its DNA. Its DNA determines what kind of proteins that organism is able to build, because you have to have instructions for how to build proteins. They don't just happen. But it's the protein that actually directly gives you or any other organism its traits, right? It's the way you think. Everything about you is because of the particular proteins that your body is able to build. And there's almost no limit to the number of proteins that can be built. There really is no limit. But you're stuck with only being able to build roughly 20,000, because those are the only ones that your cells have instructions for how to build. That's what your genes are. Okay. Other organisms have different traits because they're able to build different proteins. And that includes other humans. We're not all identical, right? We have different traits from each other because we build different proteins since we have different genes from our parents. Okay, so proteins are ideally suited to being such versatile molecules, functionally speaking. They have such a huge variety of functions, which you can see in this table on slide 15, because of the way proteins are built. First of all, they're polymers, so that means they can be really large. They don't have to be. They can be small as well, but they can be any size. But unlike the other two polymer classes, which are the polysaccharides and the polynucleotides, there is much more variability with respect to overall shape. So when you build a polynucleotide, which is a polymer out of nucleotides, DNA or RNA, it can be huge, but it's really just one long linear thing. A DNA is just a long strand. Not much variation. I mean, there isn't really any variation at all in DNA shape. It's just it can be short or long, but that's it. And carbohydrates have a little bit more variability in their shape because of the branching, but still they're mostly just long strands or branched strands. Proteins, on the other hand, can be just about any shape you want if you were designing things. Of course, organisms aren't designed. It happens by natural selection. But because there's so many possible shapes that proteins can have, the way they interact with other molecules in cells is basically unlimited, the number of ways they can do this. So that's why they have so many different kinds of functions. They form enzymes. Enzymes are catalysts, right? Now, all enzymes are proteins, but not all biological catalysts are proteins. Originally, we thought so. And the vast majority definitely are proteins, a vast majority of catalysts. But eventually we learned that in some cases RNA is able to be a catalyst as well, certain kinds of RNAs. They're not called enzymes, though. We gave them a special word to show that they're not proteins. Those are called ribozymes. Enzymes, though, the vast majority of catalysts in your body are enzymes. And that alone is a truly important aspect of proteins. I said that you roughly have 20,000 genes, far fewer than we thought originally. We learned that in one of the things we learned from the Human Genome Project is that we have roughly 20,000 genes. So we can make thousands of kinds of proteins. Well, a big fraction of those thousands of proteins that you're able to make are just thousands of different kinds of enzymes. And that's because in metabolism, which is your life, that's thousands of different kinds of reactions, trillions and trillions, quadrillions of individual chemical reactions occurring. But there's thousands of different kinds of chemical reactions occurring just within one cell. And just about every one of those individual kinds of reactions requires its own kind of catalyst, its own enzyme. That's why we have so many enzymes in our proteins.
Is there like a specific meaning to the word like zyme, like at the end? Like, is that why? Like,
yeah, but I forget exactly what that means etymologically. I'm going to have to check again because I've forgotten. But yes, there is a reason for that. Structural proteins is another big category of function. When we build things for their structure in cells or for export out of the cells, often those things are built out of proteins. Proteins can be strong fibers, for instance. We build collagen and keratin as animals, for instance, in our hair and nails, that in our skin, that makes it strong stuff. Those are structural proteins. We also have some storage proteins, although this is probably the least important in this whole list. Storage meaning storage for the purpose of energy. Usually we don't use proteins for energy very much. We don't burn our protein as fuel. We use mostly sugar and also fat if we run out of sugar. Right? This fat is there for storage. If we run out of glycogen because we haven't eaten, then we start burning our fat. But we don't start burning our protein until we're starving. Until we've used all the fat of our bodies, literally starving, not just hungry, truly starving. And that's because proteins are usually recycled. Instead of being used as fuel, you know, we take protein in as food. It's made of a bunch of amino acids. We break that down. Whatever the organism is that we ate has its own proteins. We break those down digestively while it's still outside of your body into amino acids, then bring those in and reassemble them in totally different combinations according to the instructions in our DNA to build our own proteins. So they're not really usually used as fuels, and that's why you don't need a hell of a lot of them really, because you're always renewing them. But there are some storage proteins, like, as you see, albumin in an egg. The white of an egg is almost pure protein, and that's there for storage for the whatever's growing in the egg needs energy while it's developing. The yolk, on the other hand, is almost all fat, but the albumin is protein. Transport proteins. Here, this refers to moving things around. But there's two ways that you move things around. You can move things around by simply binding to them, and proteins bind a lot of different things. So you have a protein and you hook something else onto it. The general name for that something else that hooks onto a protein is a ligand. And so, for instance, hemoglobin, as you see as the example here, is almost the only thing that's in your red blood cells. In the process of becoming mature red blood cells, they lose almost all your other familiar things in a cell, like the mitochondria and the endoplasmic reticulum and the nucleus itself. Your red blood cells don't even have nuclei, which is why they can't live very long on their own. But that's all as a way to make as much room as possible for millions of individual hemoglobin molecules packed into just one red blood cell. And they are transport proteins because oxygen molecules and carbon dioxide molecules can hook onto those hemoglobins and be carried in the blood. Carbon dioxide gets picked up by the cells of the body, delivered to the lungs to exhale it. oxygen is put onto blood at the lungs to take it to the rest of the body. But there's also transport proteins that are more correctly or more specifically called transmembrane transport proteins. These are for getting things into or out of cells through the membrane. Okay, let me see whether I can recover. hormonal proteins.
You can have some of this.
No, that's okay. I'm tough as hell. Thanks, though. Hormonal proteins are proteins that are acting as hormones, which are chemical signals, like we've talked about. So, there are two major categories of hormones. Some of them are lipid-based. The steroid hormones are lipid-based, as we've talked about. Those come from cholesterol. The rest of them, which are most of them, are built out of amino acids, so they're protein-based hormones. And that's a notice that each of these functions is drastically different from the other functions. Receptor proteins, another example of proteins that allow things to hook onto them. Ligands in general, that's the general name. So receptor proteins are proteins that are either on the surface of or inside cells that have just the right shape for signal molecules to bind to them as ligands. And when that happens, there's going to be some effect in the cell that would not occur if that signal, whatever it is, did not bind to the receptor. If you think back to the first day when I was talking about positive feedback, I gave you the example of parturition involving oxytocin, right? Remember this? Well, that oxytocin that gets released from the brain gets released, like all hormones, into the bloodstream. So that gets carried everywhere in the body. But it's only the uterus that responds to the oxytocin, because it's only uterus that has the right kind of receptors to even know that oxytocin is there. The rest of the body will just ignore it because there's no receptor for it. It's like the glove for the hand. Notice, by the way, that some signals, some of the hormones themselves are proteins, and those even though those protein hormones are already proteins, in order to work, they need to bind to receptor proteins doing the other job. And by the way, even in the case of non-protein hormones, like testosterone, for instance, even if it's a lipid-based hormone, the receptor is still a protein. Because they can have just about any shape you want. And then there are contractile and motor proteins. These also are involved in movement, but this is specifically how your muscles work, for instance, and also how things get moved around within a cell on the cytoskeleton. And then finally, which would be good timing to end, there are defensive proteins in your body that are important for your immunity, for your acquired immunity. You have innate immunity, which means you're born with it a certain amount. But you have acquired immunity that you acquire by living, by being exposed to things. Your body makes antibodies, right? Your body is continuously making antibodies randomly. But if you happen to be exposed to something that you've just randomly made an antibody that it matches, then your cell will recognize that it happens to be a match. And cells will specialize in making a hell of a lot more copies of that same kind of antibody. Which is why if you live through the original attack, whatever the invader is, if you live through the sickness, then recover. If you're exposed again to that same thing, you'll already have an army of proteins acting as antibodies on hand in your blood to kill that stuff before it can kill you. That's the basis of vaccines, yeah.
Is that why, like, if you have chickenpox one time, you're...
That's right. And this is true in general for viral diseases, which means the common cold, which is caused by a cold virus, you never get the same cold twice. The problem is you can get a cold every year because the viri are mutating. They're evolving. There's a different version every year. So you never get that same one because you have antibodies against that cold you've had, but there's another one right around the corner. Got to stop there. Well, go ahead.
Is that why when you go to the doctor and you get a vaccine, they actually
Yeah, that's what I was saying. It's the basis of vaccines. In a vaccine, what they do is slightly modify it so that it can't hurt you, but it's still molecularly similar enough that your body will make antibodies against that, and therefore if you are ever exposed to the real living thing, you'll have an army of antibodies on hand to attack. Yes. Yes. I shouldn't say necessarily living because viruses are not alive, but...